One of the great orators of the movement, Seth Luther, told a 4th of July rally, "We will try the ballot box first. If that will not affect our righteous purpose, the next and last resort is the cartridge box." And one sympathetic local newspaper, the Albany Microscope, warned, "Remember the regretted fate of the working men. They were soon destroyed by hitching teams and rolling with parties. They admitted into their ranks broken-down lawyers and politicians. They became perverted and were unconsciously drawn into a vortex from which they never escaped." The crisis of 1837 led to rallies and meetings in many cities. The banks had suspended specie payments, refusing to pay hard money for the banknotes they had issued. Prices rose, and working people, already hard-pressed to buy food, found that flour that had sold at $5.62 a barrel was now $12 a barrel. Pork went up. Coal went up. In Philadelphia, 20,000 people assembled, and someone wrote to President Van Buren describing it. "This afternoon, the largest public meeting I ever saw assembled in Independence Square. It was called by placards posted throughout the city yesterday and last night. It was projected and carried on entirely by the working classes, without consultation or cooperation with any of those who usually take the lead in such matters. The officers and speakers were of those classes. It was directed against the banks." In New York, members of the Equal Rights Party, often called the Locofocos, announced a meeting. "Bread, meat, rent, and fuel. Their prices must come down. The people will meet in the park, rain or shine, at 4 o'clock p.m. on Monday afternoon. All friends of humanity determined to resist monopolists and extortioners are invited to attend." The Commercial Register, a New York newspaper, reported on the meeting and what followed. "At 4 o'clock, a concourse of several thousands had convened in front of the city hall. One of these orators is reported to have expressly directed the popular vengeance against Mr. Eli Hart, who was one of our most extensive flour dealers on commission. 'Fellow citizens,' he exclaimed, 'Mr. Hart has now 53,000 barrels of flour in his store. Let us go and offer him $8 a barrel, and if he does not take it—'" A large body of the meeting moved off in the direction of Mr. Hart's store. The middle door had been forced, and some 20 or 30 barrels of flour or more rolled into the streets, and the heads staved in. At this point of time, Mr. Hart himself arrived on the ground with a posse of officers from the police. The officers were assailed by a portion of the mob in Day Street. Their staves wrested from them and shivered to pieces. Barrels of flour by dozens, fifties, and hundreds were tumbled into the street from the doors and thrown in rapid succession from the windows. About 1,000 bushels of wheat and 400 or 500 barrels of flour were thus wantonly and foolishly, as well as wickedly, destroyed. The most active of the destructionists were foreigners. Indeed, the greater part of the assemblage was of exotic origin, but there were probably 500 or 1,000 others standing by and abetting their incendiary labors. Amidst the falling and bursting of the barrels and sacks of wheat, numbers of women were engaged, like the crones who stripped the dead in battle, filling the boxes and baskets with which they were provided, and their aprons with flour, and making off with it. Night had now closed upon the scene, but the work of destruction did not cease until strong bodies of police arrived, followed soon afterward by detachments of troops. This was the flour riot of 1837. During the crisis of that year, 50,000 persons, one-third of the working class, were without work in New York City alone, and 200,000 of a population of 500,000 were living, as one observer put it, in utter and hopeless distress. There is no complete record of the meetings, riots, actions, organized and disorganized, violent and nonviolent, which took place in the mid-19th century, as the country grew, as the cities became crowded with working conditions bad, living conditions intolerable, with the economy in the hands of bankers, speculators, landlords, merchants. In 1835, 50 different trades organized unions in Philadelphia, and there was a successful general strike of laborers, factory workers, bookbinders, jewelers, coal heavers, butchers, cabinet workers, for the 10-hour day. Soon, there were 10-hour laws in Pennsylvania and other states, but they provided that employers could have employees sign contracts for longer hours. The law at this time was developing a strong defense of contracts. It was pretended that work contracts were voluntary agreements between equals. Weavers in Philadelphia in the early 1840s, mostly Irish immigrants working at home for employers, struck for higher wages, attacked the homes of those refusing to strike, and destroyed their work. A sheriff's posse tried to arrest some strikers, but it was broken up by 400 weavers armed with muskets and sticks. Soon, however, antagonism developed between these Irish Catholic weavers and native-born Protestant skilled workers over issues of religion. In May 1844, there were Protestant Catholic riots in Kensington, a suburb of Philadelphia. Nativist, anti-immigrant rioters destroyed the weavers' neighborhoods and attacked a Catholic church. Middle-class politicians soon led each group into a different political party, the nativists into the American Republican Party, the Irish into the Democratic Party. Party politics and religion now substituting for class conflict. The result of all this, says David Montgomery, historian of the Kensington riots, was the fragmentation of the Philadelphia working class. It thereby created for historians the illusion of a society lacking in class conflict, while in reality the class conflicts of 19th century America were as fierce as any known to the industrial world. The immigrants from Ireland, fleeing starvation there when the potato crop failed, were coming to America now, packed into old sailing ships. The stories of these ships differ only in detail from the accounts of the ships that earlier brought black slaves and later German, Italian, Russian immigrants. This is a contemporary account of one ship arriving from Ireland, detained at Gros Island on the Canadian border. On the 18th of May, 1847, the Urania from Cork, with several hundred immigrants on board, a large proportion of them sick and dying of the ship fever, was put into quarantine at Gros Island. This was the first of the plague-smitten ships from Ireland which that year sailed up the St. Lawrence. But before the first week of June, as many as 84 ships of various tonnage were driven in by an easterly wind. And of that enormous number of vessels, there was not one free from the taint of malignant typhus, the offspring of famine, and of the foul shiphold. A tolerably quick passage occupied from 6 to 8 weeks. Who can imagine the horrors of even the shortest passage in an immigrant ship crowded beyond its utmost capacity of stowage, with unhappy beings of all ages, with fever raging in their midst? The crew sullen or brutal from very desperation, or paralyzed with terror of the plague, the miserable passengers unable to help themselves or afford the least relief to each other, one-fourth or one-third or one-half of the entire number in different stages of the disease, many dying, some dead, the fatal poison intensified by the indescribable foulness of the air breathed and rebreathed by the gasping sufferers, the wails of children, the ravings of the delirious, the cries and groans of those in mortal agony. There was no accommodation of any kind on the island. Sheds were rapidly filled with the miserable people. Hundreds were literally flung on the beach, left amid the mud and stones to crawl on the dry land how they could. Many of these gasped out their last breath on that fatal shore, not able to drag themselves from the slime in which they lay. It was not until the 1st of November that the quarantine of Gros Isle was closed. Upon that barren isle, as many as 10,000 of the Irish race were consigned to the grave pit. How could these new Irish immigrants, themselves poor and despised, become sympathizers with the black slave, who was becoming more and more the center of attention, the subject of agitation in the country? Indeed, most working-class activists at this time ignored the plight of blacks. Eli Moore, a New York trade union leader elected to Congress, argued in the House of Representatives against receiving abolitionist petitions. Racist hostility became an easy substitute for class frustration. On the other hand, a white shoemaker wrote in 1848 in The Awl, the newspaper of Lynn Shoe factory workers, "We are nothing but a standing army that keeps 3 million of our brethren in bondage, living under the shade of Bunker Hill Monument, demanding in the name of humanity our right, and withholding those rights from others because their skin is black. Is it any wonder that God in his righteous anger has punished us by forcing us to drink the bitter cup of degradation?" The anger of the city poor often expressed itself in futile violence over nationality or religion. In New York in 1849, a mob, largely Irish, stormed the fashionable Astor Place Opera House, where an English actor, William Charles Macready, was playing Macbeth, in competition with an American actor, Edwin Forrest, who was acting the same role in another production. The crowd shouting, "Burn the damned den of aristocracy," charged, throwing bricks. The militia were called out, and in the violence that followed, about 200 people were killed or wounded. Another economic crisis came in 1857. The boom in railroads and manufacturing, the surge of immigration, the increased speculation in stocks and bonds, the stealing, corruption, manipulation, led to wild expansion and then crash. By October of that year, 200,000 were unemployed, and thousands of recent immigrants crowded into the eastern ports, hoping to work their way back to Europe. The New York Times reported, "Every ship for Liverpool now has all the passengers she can carry, and multitudes are applying to work their passage if they have no money to pay for it." In Newark, New Jersey, a rally of several thousand demanded the city give work to the unemployed. And in New York, 15,000 people met at Tompkins Square in downtown Manhattan. From there, they marched to Wall Street and paraded around the stock exchange shouting, "We want work!" That summer, riots occurred in the slum areas of New York. A mob of 500 attacked the police one day with pistols and bricks. There were parades of the unemployed demanding bread and work, looting shops. In November, a crowd occupied City Hall, and the U.S. Marines were brought in to drive them out. Of the country's workforce of 6 million in 1850, 500,000 were women. 330,000 worked as domestics. 55,000 were teachers. Of the 181,000 women in factories, half worked in textile mills. They organized. Women struck by themselves for the first time in 1825. They were the United Tailoresses of New York, demanding higher wages. In 1828, the first strike of mill women on their own took place in Dover, New Hampshire, when several hundred women paraded with banners and flags. They shot off gunpowder in protest against new factory rules, which charged fines for coming late, forbade talking on the job, and required church attendance. They were forced to return to the mill, their demands unmet, and their leaders were fired and blacklisted. In Exeter, New Hampshire, women mill workers went on strike, turned out in the language of that day, because the overseer was setting the clocks back to get more time from them. Their strike succeeded in exacting a promise from the company that the overseers would set their watches right. The Lowell system, in which young girls would go to work in the mills and live in dormitories supervised by matrons, at first seemed beneficent, sociable, a welcome escape from household drudgery or domestic service. Lowell, Massachusetts, was the first town created for the textile mill industry. It was named after the wealthy and influential Lowell family. But the dormitories became prison-like, controlled by rules and regulations. The supper, served after the women had risen at 4 a.m. and worked until 7:30 in the evening, often consisted merely of bread and gravy. So the Lowell girls organized. They started their own newspapers. They protested against the weaving rooms, which were poorly lit, badly ventilated, impossibly hot in the summer, damp and cold in the winter. In 1834, a cut in wages led the Lowell women to strike, proclaiming, "Union is power. Our present object is to have union and exertion, and we remain in possession of our own unquestionable rights." But the threat of hiring others to replace them brought them back to work at reduced wages. The leaders were fired. The young women, determined to do better next time, organized a Factory Girls Association, and 1,500 went on strike in 1836 against a raise in boarding house charges. Harriet Hansen was an 11-year-old girl working in the mill. She later recalled, "I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I had been an ardent listener to what was said against this attempt at oppression on the part of the corporation, and naturally I took sides with the strikers. When the day came on which the girls were to turn out, those in the upper room started first, and so many of them left that our mill was at once shut down. Then when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, I, who began to think they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with childish bravado, 'I don't care what you do, I am going to turn out, whether anyone else does or not.' And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I look back at the long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been since." The strikers marched through the streets of Lowell singing. They held out a month, but then their money ran out. They were evicted from the boarding houses, and many of them went back to work. The leaders were fired, including Harriet Hansen's widowed mother, a matron in the boarding house, who was blamed for her child's going out on strike. Resistance continued. One mill in Lowell, Herbert Gutman reports, discharged 28 women for such reasons as misconduct, disobedience, impudence, levity, and mutiny. Meanwhile, the girls tried to hold on to thoughts about fresh air, the country, a less harried way of life. One of them recalled, "I never cared much for machinery. I could not see into their complications or feel interested in them. In sweet June weather, I would lean far out of the window and try not to hear the unceasing clash of sound inside." In New Hampshire, 500 men and women petitioned the Amaskeag Manufacturing Company not to cut down an elm tree to make space for another mill. They said it was a beautiful and goodly tree, representing a time when the yell of the red man and the scream of the eagle were alone heard on the banks of the Merrimack, instead of two giant edifices filled with the buzz of busy and well-remunerated industry. In 1835, 20 mills went on strike to reduce the workday from 13.5 hours to 11 hours, to get cash wages instead of company scrip, and to end fines for lateness. 1,500 children and parents went out on strike, and it lasted 6 weeks. Strikebreakers were brought in, and some workers went back to work. But the strikers did win a 12-hour day and 9 hours on Saturday. That year and the next, there were 140 strikes in the eastern part of the United States. The crisis that followed the 1837 panic stimulated the formation in 1845 of the Female Labor Reform Association in Lowell, which sent thousands of petitions to the Massachusetts legislature asking for a 10-hour day. Finally, the legislature decided to hold public hearings, the first investigation of labor conditions by any governmental body in the country. Eliza Hemingway told the committee of the air thick with smoke from oil lamps burning before sunup and after sundown. Judith Payne told of her sickness due to the work in the mills. But after the committee visited the mills, for which the company prepared by a cleanup job, it reported, "Your committee returned fully satisfied that the order, decorum, and general appearance of things in and around the mills could not be improved by any suggestion of theirs or by any act of the legislature." The report was denounced by the Female Labor Reform Association, and they worked successfully for the committee chairman's defeat at the next election, though they could not vote. But not much was done to change conditions in the mills. In the late 1840s, the New England farm women who worked in the mills began to leave them, as more and more Irish immigrants took their place. Company towns now grew up around mills in Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, using immigrant workers who signed contracts pledging everyone in the family to work for a year. They lived in slum tenements owned by the company, were paid in scrip, which they could use only at company stores, and were evicted if their work was unsatisfactory. In Paterson, New Jersey, the first of a series of mill strikes was started by children. When the company suddenly put off their dinner hour from noon to 1 p.m., the children marched off the job, their parents cheering them on. They were joined by other working people in the town, carpenters, masons, machinists, who turned the strike into a 10-hour day struggle. After a week, however, with the threat of bringing in militia, the children returned to work and their leaders were fired. Soon after, trying to prevent more trouble, the company restored the noon dinner hour. It was the shoemakers of Lynn, Massachusetts, a factory town northeast of Boston, who started the largest strike to take place in the United States before the Civil War. Lynn had pioneered in the use of sewing machines in factories, replacing shoemaker artisans. The factory workers in Lynn, who began to organize in the 1830s, later started a militant newspaper, The Awl. In 1844, 4 years before Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto appeared, The Awl wrote, "The division of society into the producing and the non-producing classes, and the fact of the unequal distribution of value between the two, introduces us at once to another distinction, that of capital and labor. Labor now becomes a commodity. Antagonism and opposition of interest is introduced in the community. Capital and labor stand opposed." The economic crisis of 1857 brought the shoe business to a halt, and the workers of Lynn lost their jobs. There was already anger at machine stitching replacing shoemakers. Prices were up, wages were repeatedly cut. And by the fall of 1859, men were earning $3 a week and women were earning $1 a week, working 16 hours a day. In early 1860, a mass meeting of the newly formed Mechanics Association demanded higher wages. When the manufacturers refused to meet with their committees, the workers called a strike for Washington's birthday. That morning, 3,000 shoemakers met in the Lyceum Hall in Lynn and set up committees of 100 to post the names of scabs, to guard against violence, to make sure shoes would not be sent out to be finished elsewhere. In a few days, shoe workers throughout New England joined the strike in Natick, Newburyport, Haverhill, Marblehead, and other Massachusetts towns, as well as towns in New Hampshire and Maine. In a week, strikes had begun in all the shoe towns of New England, with mechanics associations in 25 towns and 20,000 shoe workers on strike. Newspapers called it the Revolution at the North, the rebellion among the workmen of New England, beginning of the conflict between capital and labor. 1,000 women and 5,000 men marched through the streets of Lynn in a blizzard, carrying banners and American flags. Women shoebinders and stitchers joined the strike and held their own mass meeting. A New York Herald reporter wrote of them, They assail the bosses in a style which reminds one of the amiable females who participated in the first French Revolution. A huge ladies' procession was organized, the women marching through streets high with snowdrifts, carrying signs, "American ladies will not be slaves, weak in physical strength but strong in moral courage. We dare battle for the right, shoulder to shoulder with our fathers, husbands, and brothers." 10 days after that, a procession of 10,000 striking workers, including delegations from Salem, Marblehead, and other towns, men and women marched through Lynn in what was the greatest demonstration of labor to take place in New England up to that time. Police from Boston and militia were sent in to make sure strikers did not interfere with shipments of shoes to be finished out of state. The strike processions went on while city grocers and provisions dealers provided food for the strikers. The strike continued through March with morale high, but by April it was losing force. The manufacturers offered higher wages to bring the strikers back into the factories, but without recognizing the unions, so that workers still had to face the employer as individuals. Most of the shoe workers were native-born Americans. Alan Dawley says in his study of the Lynn strike, Class and Community, they did not accept the social and political order that kept them in poverty, however much it was praised in American schools, churches, and newspapers. In Lynn, he says, articulate, activist, Irish shoe and leather workers joined Yankees in flatly rejecting the myth of success. Irish and Yankee workers jointly looked for labor candidates when they went to the polls and resisted strike-breaking by local police. Trying to understand why this fierce class spirit did not lead to independent revolutionary political action, Dawley concludes that the main reason is that electoral politics drained the energies of the resistors into the channels of the system. Dawley disputes some historians who have said the high rate of mobility of workers prevented them from organizing in revolutionary ways. He says that while there was a high turnover in Lynn, too, this masked the existence of a virtually permanent minority who played the key role in organizing discontent. He also suggests that mobility helps people see that others are in similar conditions. He thinks the struggle of European workers for political democracy, even while they sought economic equality, made them class conscious. American workers, however, had already gained political democracy by the 1830s, and so their economic battles could be taken over by political parties that blurred class lines. Even this might not have stopped labor militancy and the rise of class consciousness, Dawley says, if not for the fact that an entire generation was sidetracked in the 1860s because of the Civil War. Northern wage earners who rallied to the Union cause became allied with their employers. National issues took over from class issues. At a time when scores of industrial communities like Lynn were seething with resistance to industrialism, national politics were preoccupied with the issues of war and reconstruction. And on these issues, the political parties took positions, offered choices, obscured the fact that the political system itself and the wealthy classes it represented were responsible for the problems they now offered to solve. Class consciousness was overwhelmed during the Civil War, both North and South, by military and political unity in the crisis of war. That unity was weaned by rhetoric and enforced by arms. It was a war proclaimed as a war for liberty, but working people would be attacked by soldiers if they dared to strike. Indians would be massacred in Colorado by the U.S. Army. And those daring to criticize Lincoln's policies would be put in jail without trial, perhaps 30,000 political prisoners. Still, there were signs in both sections of dissent from that unity. Anger of poor against rich, rebellion against the dominant political and economic forces. In the North, the war brought high prices for food and the necessities of life. Prices of milk Eggs, cheese, were up 60 to 100% for families that had not been able to pay the old prices. One historian, Emerson Fite, Social and Industrial Conditions in the North During the Civil War, described the war situation. Employers were wont to appropriate to themselves all or nearly all of the profits accruing from the higher prices, without being willing to grant to the employees a fair share of these profits through the medium of higher wages. There were strikes all over the country during the war. The Springfield Republican in 1863 said that, "The workmen of almost every branch of trade have had their strikes within the last few months." And the San Francisco Evening Bulletin said, "Striking for higher wages is now the rage among the working people in San Francisco." Unions were being formed as a result of these strikes. Philadelphia shoemakers in 1863 announced that high prices made organization imperative. The headline in Fincher's Trades Review of November 21, 1863, "The Revolution in New York," was an exaggeration, but its list of labor activities was impressive evidence of the hidden resentments of the poor during the war. "The upheaval of the laboring masses in New York has startled the capitalists of that city and vicinity. The machinists are making a bold stand. We publish their appeal in another column. The city railroad employees struck for higher wages and made the whole population for a few days ride on Shanks' mare. The house painters of Brooklyn have taken steps to counteract the attempt of the bosses to reduce their wages. The house carpenters, we are informed, are pretty well out of the woods, and their demands are generally complied with. The safe makers have obtained an increase of wages and are now at work. The lithographic printers are making efforts to secure better pay for their labor. The workmen on the ironclads are yet holding out against the contractors. The window shade painters have obtained an advance of 25%. The horseshoers are fortifying themselves against the evils of money and trade fluctuations. The sash and blind makers are organized and ask their employers for 25% additional. The sugar packers are remodeling their list of prices. The glass cutters demand 15% to present wages. Imperfect as we confess our list to be, there is enough to convince the reader that the social revolution now working its way through the land must succeed if working men are only true to each other. The stage drivers to the number of 800 are on strike. The working men of Boston are not behind, in addition to the strike at the Charlestown Navy Yard. The riggers are on strike. At this writing, it is rumored, says the Boston Post, that a general strike is contemplated among the workmen in the iron establishments at South Boston and other parts of the city. The war brought many women into shops and factories, often over the objections of men who saw them driving wage scales down. In New York City, girls sewed umbrellas from 6 a.m. to midnight, earning $3 a week, from which employers deducted the cost of needles and thread. Girls who made cotton shirts received 24 cents for a 12-hour day. In late 1863, New York working women held a mass meeting to find a solution to their problems. A Working Women's Protective Union was formed, and there was a strike of women umbrella workers in New York and Brooklyn. In Providence, Rhode Island, a ladies' cigar makers' union was organized. Altogether, by 1864, about 200,000 workers, men and women, were in trade unions, forming national unions in some of the trades, putting out labor newspapers. Union troops were used to break strikes. Federal soldiers were sent to Cold Springs, New York, to end a strike at a gunworks where workers wanted a wage increase. Striking machinists and tailors in St. Louis were forced back to work by the army. In Tennessee, a Union general arrested and sent out of the state 200 striking mechanics. When engineers on the Reading Railroad struck, troops broke that strike as they did with miners in Tioga County, Pennsylvania. White workers of the North were not enthusiastic about a war, which seemed to be fought for the black slave or for the capitalist, for anyone but them. They worked in semi-slave conditions themselves. They thought the war was profiting the new class of millionaires. They saw defective guns sold to the army by contractors, sand sold as sugar, rye sold as coffee, shop sweepings made into clothing and blankets, paper-soled shoes produced for soldiers at the front, navy ships made of rotting timbers, soldiers' uniforms that fell apart in the rain. The Irish working people of New York, recent immigrants, poor, looked upon with contempt by Native Americans, could hardly find sympathy for the black population of the city who competed with them for jobs as longshoremen, barbers, waiters, domestic servants. Blacks pushed out of these jobs often were used to break strikes. Then came the war, the draft, the chance of death, and the Conscription Act of 1863 provided that the rich could avoid military service. They could pay $300 or buy a substitute. In the summer of 1863, a song of the conscripts was circulated by the thousands in New York and other cities. One stanza. We're coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more. We leave our homes and firesides with bleeding hearts and sore. Since poverty has been our crime, we bow to thy decree. We are the poor and have no wealth to purchase liberty. When recruiting for the army began in July 1863, a mob in New York wrecked the main recruiting station. Then for 3 days, crowds of white workers marched through the city, destroying buildings, factories, streetcar lines, homes. The draft riots were complex, anti-black, anti-rich, anti-Republican. From an assault on draft headquarters, the rioters went on to attacks on wealthy homes, then to the murder of blacks. They marched through the streets, forcing factories to close, recruiting more members of the mob. They set the city's colored orphan asylum on fire. They shot, burned, and hanged blacks they found in the streets. Many people were thrown into the rivers to drown. On the fourth day, Union troops returning from the Battle of Gettysburg came into the city and stopped the rioting. Perhaps 400 people were killed. No exact figures have ever been given, but the number of lives lost was greater than in any other incident of domestic violence in American history. Joel Tyler Headley, The Great Riots of New York, gave a graphic day-by-day description of what happened. Second day, the fire bells, continually ringing, increased the terror that every hour became more widespread. Especially was this true of the Negro population. At one time there lay at the corner of 27th Street and 7th Avenue the dead body of a Negro, stripped, nearly naked, and around it a collection of Irishmen, absolutely dancing or shouting like wild Indians. A Negro barber shop was next attacked, and the torch applied to it. A Negro lodging house in the same street next received the visit of these furies and was soon a mass of ruins. Old men, 70 years of age, and young children too young to comprehend what it all meant, were cruelly beaten and killed. There were anti-draft riots, not so prolonged or bloody, in other northern cities. Newark, Troy, Boston, Toledo, Evansville. In Boston, the dead were Irish workers attacking an armory who were fired on by soldiers. In the South, beneath the apparent unity of the white Confederacy, there was also conflict. Most whites, 2/3 of them, did not own slaves. A few thousand families made up the plantation elite. The federal census of 1850 showed that 1,000 Southern families at the top of the economy received about $50 million a year income, while all the other families, about 660,000, received about $60 million a year. Millions of Southern whites were poor farmers, living in shacks or abandoned outhouses, cultivating land so bad the plantation owners had abandoned it. Just before the Civil War in Jackson, Mississippi, Slaves working in a cotton factory received 20 cents a day for board, and white workers at the same factory received 30 cents. A newspaper in North Carolina in August 1855 spoke of hundreds of thousands of working-class families existing upon half-starvation from year to year. Behind the rebel battle yells and the legendary spirit of the Confederate Army, there was much reluctance to fight. A sympathetic historian of the South, E. Merton Coulter, asked, "Why did the Confederacy fail? The forces leading to defeat were many, but they may be summed up in this one fact. The people did not will hard enough and long enough to win. Not money or soldiers, but willpower and morale were decisive." The conscription law of the Confederacy, too, provided that the rich could avoid service. Did Confederate soldiers begin to suspect they were fighting for the privileges of an elite they could never belong to? In April 1863, there was a bread riot in Richmond. That summer, draft riots occurred in various southern cities. In September, a bread riot in Mobile, Alabama. Georgia Lee Tatum, in her study, Disloyalty in the Confederacy, writes, "Before the end of the war, there was much disaffection in every state, and many of the disloyal had formed into bands, in some states into well-organized active societies." The Civil War was one of the first instances in the world of modern warfare. Deadly artillery shells, Gatling guns, bayonet charges, combining the indiscriminate killing of mechanized war with hand-to-hand combat. The nightmare scenes could not adequately be described except in a novel like Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. In one charge before Petersburg, Virginia, a regiment of 850 Maine soldiers lost 632 men in half an hour. It was a vast butchery. 623,000 dead on both sides, and 471,000 wounded. Over 1 million dead and wounded in a country whose population was 30 million. No wonder that desertions grew among Southern soldiers as the war went on. As for the Union Army, by the end of the war, 200,000 had deserted. Still, 600,000 had volunteered for the Confederacy in 1861, and many in the Union Army were volunteers. The psychology of patriotism, the lure of adventure, the aura of moral crusade created by political leaders worked effectively to dim class resentments against the rich and powerful, and turn much of the anger against the enemy. As Edmund Wilson put it in Patriotic Gore, written after World War II, "We have seen in our most recent wars how a divided and arguing public opinion may be converted overnight into a national near unanimity, an obedient flood of energy which will carry the young to destruction and overpower any effort to stem it. The unanimity of men at war is like that of a school of fish which will swerve simultaneously and apparently without leadership when the shadow of an enemy appears, or like a sky-darkening flight of grasshoppers, which also, compelled by one impulse, will descend to consume the crops." Under the deafening noise of the war, Congress was passing, and Lincoln was signing into law, a whole series of acts to give business interests what they wanted, and what the agrarian South had blocked before secession. The Republican platform of 1860 had been a clear appeal to businessmen. Now Congress in 1861 passed the Morrill Tariff. This made foreign goods more expensive, allowed American manufacturers to raise their prices, and forced American consumers to pay more. The following year, a Homestead Act was passed. It gave 160 acres of western land, unoccupied and publicly owned, to anyone who would cultivate it for 5 years. Anyone willing to pay $1.25 an acre could buy a homestead. Few ordinary people had the $200 necessary to do this. Speculators moved in and bought up much of the land. Homestead land added up to 50 million acres. But during the Civil War, over 100 million acres were given by Congress and the President to various railroads free of charge. Congress also set up a national bank, putting the government into partnership with the banking interests, guaranteeing their profits. With strikes spreading, employers pressed Congress for help. The contract labor law of 1864 made it possible for companies to sign contracts with foreign workers whenever the workers pledged to give 12 months of their wages to pay the cost of emigration. This gave the employers during the Civil War not only very cheap labor, but strikebreakers. More important, perhaps, than the federal laws passed by Congress for the benefit of the rich, were the day-to-day operations of local and state laws for the benefit of landlords and merchants. Gustavus Myers, in his History of the Great American Fortunes, comments on this in discussing the growth of the Astor family's fortune, much of it out of the rents of New York tenements. Is it not murder when, compelled by want, people are forced to fester in squalid, germ-filled tenements where the sunlight never enters and where disease finds a prolific breeding place? Untold thousands went to their deaths in these unspeakable places. Yet so far as the law was concerned, the rents collected by the Astors, as well as by other landlords, were honestly made. The whole institution of law saw nothing out of the way in these conditions, and very significantly so, because to repeat over and over again, law did not represent the ethics or ideals of an advanced humanity. It exactly reflected, as a pool reflects the sky, the demands and self-interest of the growing propertied classes. In the 30 years leading up to the Civil War, the law was increasingly interpreted in the courts to suit the capitalist development of the country. Studying this, Morton Horowitz, The Transformation of American Law, points out that the English common law was no longer holy when it stood in the way of business growth. Mill owners were given the legal right to destroy other people's property by flood to carry on their business. The law of eminent domain was used to take farmers' land and give it to canal companies or railroad companies as subsidies. Judgments for damages against businessmen were taken out of the hands of juries, which were unpredictable, and given to judges. Private settlement of disputes by arbitration was replaced by court settlements, creating more dependence on lawyers, and the legal profession gained in importance. The ancient idea of a fair price for goods gave way in the courts to the idea of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, thus throwing generations of consumers from that time on to the mercy of businessmen. That contract law was intended to discriminate against working people and for business is shown by Horowitz in the following example of the early 19th century. The court said that if a worker signed a contract to work for a year and left before the year was up, he was not entitled to any wages even for the time he had worked. But the courts at the same time said that if a building business broke a contract, it was entitled to be paid for whatever had been done up to that point. The pretense of the law was that a worker and a railroad made a contract with equal bargaining power. Thus, a Massachusetts judge decided an injured worker did not deserve compensation because by signing the contract he was agreeing to take certain risks. The circle was completed. The law had come simply to ratify those forms of inequality that the market system produced. It was a time when the law did not even pretend to protect working people as it would in the next century. Health and safety laws were either non-existent or unenforced. In Lawrence, Massachusetts, in 1860, on a winter day, the Pemberton Mill collapsed, with 900 workers inside, mostly women. 88 died, and although there was evidence that the structure had never been adequate to support the heavy machinery inside, and that this was known to the construction engineer, a jury found no evidence of criminal intent. Horwitz sums up what happened in the courts of law by the time of the Civil War. By the middle of the 19th century, the legal system had been reshaped to the advantage of men of commerce and industry at the expense of farmers, workers, consumers, and other less powerful groups within the society. It actively promoted a legal redistribution of wealth against the weakest groups in the society. In pre-modern times, the maldistribution of wealth was accomplished by simple force. In modern times, exploitation is disguised. It is accomplished by law, which has the look of neutrality and fairness. By the time of the Civil War, modernization was well underway in the United States. With the war over, the urgency of national unity slackened, and ordinary people could turn more to their daily lives, their problems of survival. The disbanded armies now were in the streets looking for work. In June 1865, Fincher's Trades Review reported, "As was to be expected, the returned soldiers are flooding the streets already, unable to find employment." The cities to which the soldiers returned were death traps of typhus, tuberculosis, hunger, and fire. In New York, 100,000 people lived in the cellars of the slums. 12,000 women worked in houses of prostitution to keep from starving. The garbage lying 2 feet deep in the streets was alive with rats. In Philadelphia, while the rich got fresh water from the Schuylkill River, everyone else drank from the Delaware, into which 13 million gallons of sewage were dumped every day. In the Great Chicago Fire in 1871, the tenements fell so fast, one after another, that people said it sounded like an earthquake. A movement for the 8-hour day began among working people after the war, helped by the formation of the first National Federation of Unions, the National Labor Union. A 3-month strike of 100,000 workers in New York won the 8-hour day, and at a victory celebration in June 1872, 150,000 workers paraded through the city. The New York Times wondered what proportion of the strikers were thoroughly American. Women brought into the industry during the war organized unions, cigar makers, tailoresses, umbrella sewers, cap makers, printers, laundresses, shoe workers. They formed the Daughters of St. Crispin and succeeded in getting the Cigar Makers Union and the National Typographical Union to admit women for the first time. A woman named Gussie Lewis of New York became corresponding secretary of the Typographers Union. But the cigar makers and typographers were only two of the 30-odd national unions, and the general attitude toward women was one of exclusion. In 1869, the collar laundresses of Troy, New York, whose work involved standing over the washtub and over the ironing table with furnaces on either side, the thermometer averaging 100 degrees for wages averaging $2 and $3 a week, according to a contemporary account, went on strike. Their leader was Kate Mullaney, second vice president of the National Labor Union. 7,000 people came to a rally to support them, and the women organized a cooperative collar and cuff factory to provide work and keep the strike going. But as time went on, outside support dwindled. The employers began making a paper collar, requiring fewer laundresses. The strike failed. The dangers of mill work intensified efforts to organize. Work often went on around the clock. At a mill in Providence, Rhode Island, fire broke out one night in 1866. There was panic among the 600 workers, mostly women, and many jumped to their deaths from upper-story windows. In Fall River, Massachusetts, women weavers formed a union independent of the men weavers. They refused to take a 10% wage cut that the men had accepted, struck against three mills, won the men's support, and brought to a halt 3,500 looms and 156,000 spindles with 3,200 workers on strike. But their children needed food. They had to return to work, signing an ironclad oath, later called a yellow dog contract, not to join a union. Black workers at this time found the National Labor Union reluctant to organize them. So they formed their own unions and carried on their own strikes, like the levee workers in Mobile, Alabama in 1867, Negro longshoremen in Charleston, dock workers in Savannah. This probably stimulated the National Labor Union at its 1869 convention to resolve to organize women and Negroes, declaring that it recognized neither color nor sex on the question of the rights of labor. A journalist wrote about the remarkable signs of racial unity at this convention. When a native Mississippian and an ex-Confederate officer in addressing a convention refers to a colored delegate who has preceded him as the gentleman from Georgia, when an ardent and democratic partisan from New York at that declares with a rich Irish brogue that he asks for himself no privilege as a mechanic or as a citizen, that he is not willing to concede to every other man, white or black, then one may indeed be warranted in asserting that time works curious changes. Most unions, however, still kept Negroes out or asked them to form their own locals. The National Labor Union began to expend more and more of its energy on political issues, especially currency reform, a demand for the issuance of paper money, greenbacks. As it became less an organizer of labor struggles and more a lobbyist with Congress, concerned with voting, it lost vitality. An observer of the labor scene, F.A. Sorge, wrote in 1870 to Karl Marx in England, "The National Labor Union, which had such brilliant prospects in the beginning of its career, was poisoned by greenbackism and is slowly but surely dying." Perhaps unions could not easily see the limits to legislative reform in an age where such reform laws were being passed for the first time and hopes were high. The Pennsylvania legislature in 1869 passed a Mine Safety Act providing for the regulation and ventilation of mines and for the protection of the lives of the miners. Only after 100 years of continuing accidents in those mines would it be understood how insufficient those words were, except as a device to calm anger among the miners. In 1873, another economic crisis devastated the nation. It was the closing of the banking house of Jay Cook, the banker who during the war had made $3 million a year in commissions alone for selling government bonds, that started the wave of panic. While President Grant slept in Cook's Philadelphia mansion on September 18, 1873, the banker rode downtown to lock the door on his bank. Now people could not pay loans on mortgages. 5,000 businesses closed and put their workers on the street. It was more than Jay Cook. The crisis was built into a system which was chaotic in its nature, in which only the very rich were secure. It was a system of periodic crisis, 1837, 1857, 1873, and later 1893, 1907, 1919, 1929. That wiped out small businesses and brought cold, hunger, and death to working people, while the fortunes of the Astors, Vanderbilts, Rockefellers, Morgans kept growing through war and peace, crisis and recovery. During the 1873 crisis, Carnegie was capturing the steel market. Rockefeller was wiping out his competitors in oil. "Labor Depression in Brooklyn" was the headline in the New York Herald in November 1873. It listed closings and layoffs, a felt skirt factory, a picture frame factory, a glass cutting establishment, a steelworks factory, and women's trades, milliners, dressmakers, shoe binders. The Depression continued through the 1870s. During the first 3 months of 1874, 90,000 workers, almost half of them women, had to sleep in police stations in New York. They were known as revolvers because they were limited to 1 or 2 days a month.